4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with Dr. Meg Laumann, also known as Canopy Meg. Stay with us.
I'm Samantha Larson. I'm here with Dr. Meg Laumann, otherwise known as Canopy Meg, who is a professor at North Carolina State University and the director of the Nature Research Center. Thank you for joining me.
Well, I'm so honored. This is really fun.
So I was wondering if you could describe what it's like to be in the canopy. It's such a cool place to be that so few people get to experience.
It is amazing to me to think that actually only in the last 40 years have we even explored the tops of trees, because it is a fantastic place. And I kind of laugh to myself because, in a way, we've had foresters for decades and centuries, and people would walk in the woods and they would only see the first 10 feet at most of a whole big forest like a redwood. And it's almost like going to the doctor, and if he checked your big toe and said, oh, you're perfectly healthy, you would go home again. It's like just such a small part of the whole body of the forest. So when I first went in the canopy, I couldn't believe it. Again, I was a little nervous because I didn't have a comfort zone of any colleagues or any other people doing this. But it was so fantastic. And literally, I always remember the noise when I got up there. The forest floor in a rainforest is relatively quiet. And sometimes people who walk through a tropical forest say, oh, this is boring. It's really, there's not so much life here after all. But really, the action is in the canopy. It's where the flowers are, the fruits, the pollinators, and things are buzzing around.
Yeah.
And the eating noise. This is so funny, but there's so many millions of beetles and so much biodiversity, and a lot of them are eating foliage, which is what I ended up studying extensively, because I had to, because these beetles kept eating all my leaves I was measuring. And so in the end, it's just full of life. And I think the take-home message is that it is another world. E.O. Wilson calls it the eighth continent of the planet. And he's right. It's just a whole different world. And a lot of things up there never get to the forest floor. Consequently, we've discovered a lot of important things go on up there that we really need to learn about. So it's awesome.
Yeah.
What can I say?
So you're perhaps best known for climbing trees in the rainforest around the world. But while climbing trees certainly appeals to the public imagination, you really started climbing trees as a means to an end for the sake of ecology. What was that process of figuring out how to climb these trees like? Was it something that was often done when you first started doing it, or did you have to kind of figure out how to do this yourself?
The whole business of canopy research is relatively new. It's kind of amazing to me still. And in a way, it's very similar to the development of scuba in the 1950s, which opened up everybody's opportunities for coral reef research. And in 1978, ancient times, I went and started a PhD in the Australian tropical forests, and I was really interested in how long did a leaf live in the canopy, because I came from a temperate forest and everybody knew they only live 6 months in the temperate. So this is this very basic question that puzzled me, and I thought that would be kind of fun to figure out the energetics of the forest and what happens to a leaf, what eats it, all these other kind of cool things. But my advisor said, well, that means you'll have to go into the canopy. And I said, what? I said, can't I train a monkey? Can't I use my binoculars or something? And he said, no, you'll have to figure something out. And by chance, I noticed there was a caving club at Sydney University. And so I went to caving club advisors, and they they laughed. They said, what, a girl in a tree? This is crazy. Australia was pretty chauvinistic at that time. But I took their kind of methodology. I made a harness with a sewing machine out of seatbelt webbing, and I got a slingshot that I molded in the shop of the university physical plant, and away I went, and it was really amazing. But cavers taught me to go up, whereas they usually go down.
Right. Can you describe the system a bit?
Sure.
Shoot over the rope with your slingshot.
Real
and then
cowboy stuff.
Yeah.
the slingshot is a real hit. As I mentioned, my first slingshot was just a piece of metal welded with an actual inner tube rubber band that I made, a giant piece of rubber that I cut out of an inner tube. And that's because slingshots were illegal in Australia, of all funny things.
Really?
Everyone had a shotgun in the outback, but for some reason, slingshots were against the law. So I did that. I bought rope. You can get fantastic rope, of course, from outfitters. In the 70s, I didn't have the wonders of REI catalogs or, you know, some of these different outfitters that Americans had. So I had to really wing it. And I did have these cavers as advisors. And eventually I came back to the States and bought a lot of my equipment. But you need twice as much rope as the height of the tree you're going up. You need to have the fantastic harness. The more comfy, the better, of course. My first one was
not
really uncomfortable. I can't believe it. I guess I was numb. And then you need to have carabiners, which are the safety links to hook onto things, and jumars, which is an ascending device, and then some kind of descending device, of which there are many, figure eights, whale's tails, all kinds of things to come back down. And for me as a researcher, I usually took a bucket of all things that I tied with a carabiner to my rope so that I have my notebook, my camera, all that extra gear. If I had it in a backpack, you see, it would interfere with the harness and I couldn't really reach it. So the bucket was my little invention. And then I could put a bottle of water. I put up whatever I wanted, my sandwich, my Oreo cookies, which was my favorite snack.
I kind of think that the fact that so few people venture into the trees and spend most of their lives on the forest floor, if they visit the forest, can be used as a metaphor for a lot of the environmental problems that we face today. That people are so focused on what's right in front of them that they totally miss what's going on above them. Does it seem to you that it's true that more people need to metaphorically look above them to get a sense of the bigger picture of what's going on in the world?
It's a really great example. I need to remember that in my next lecture. I think you're right. In a lot of senses, we didn't look at the whole or the big picture initially with forests, and all of a sudden people missed out on almost half of the biodiversity on the terrestrial part of the planet. We didn't know about things like carbon sequestration. We didn't know about gas exchange to the extent that we needed to know. We didn't understand about how much, you know, the climate over the forest was really impacting the health of the trees and also a lot of the biodiversity. So the answer is yes, that's a great metaphor. It's so easy sometimes to see what's in front of our nose, or as human beings to probably shy away from something that's a little more difficult. And I think climbing trees is a lot of fun, but people remind me that there's gravity to overcome.
Yeah.
There are stinging ants. There are unknowns, and that makes some people nervous. So probably in the world of environmental issues, we oftentimes do want to look at what's comfortable or what's right in front of us.
And you're someone who's quite focused on science communication. Have you found that there are ways to package these complex messages that make them more easier for people to grasp?
One interesting description that I like to use with young people in particular is that the canopy of the rainforest is like a giant salad bar, and it's an all-you-can-eat. And, you know, some of the interesting questions we ask is, why don't the beetles eat up all of the leaves? Why do they eat some kinds of trees and not others? But it's almost similar to if you were to go into a big giant hall restaurant and pick out what you want to put in your own salad.
Right.
So these insects are really selective. There's amazing issues with chemicals and thorns and hair, stinging hairs. And of course, that's how we end up with all of these medicinal plants, because the plants themselves can't escape their enemies, mostly insects. They have to develop defensive chemicals. And so I think the salad bar analogy is really great. I found over time that there is a charismatic appeal, I think, for a tree climbing scientist. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have some recall in their childhood of a tree fort or going outside into nature. And so that's another little appeal or a hook, as you might say, in the science communication world. And obviously, some of the critters that live in the forest are fantastic. I'm actually a botanist by training, which is very tough to compete against people who study chimpanzees or dolphins, you know, especially in fundraising. How do you make a tree sexy? But there are incredible things. The sex life of figs is quite amazing. And then there are, of course, all these animals that live in the trees. So I've been able to try to weave together stories about the lifestyles of all of these amazing complex interactions in the canopy. And I think those are the stories that make it really fun. Everything from koalas in the dry forest to sloths to, you know, extraordinary flying snakes and fantastic camouflaged beetles and ants everywhere. It's fantastic and it's full of life. And unfortunately, we're still probably, you know, trying to figure out what lives there. We probably know less than 2% of those organisms. We've probably classified less than 1%. So it's a huge battle against time. I try to keep optimistic and get people inspired about all of the amazing facts about tropical rainforests. But in actual fact, we need so much more energy and funds and resources devoted to rainforest research if we're going to really understand the forest health, which in turn controls our health as human beings on this planet.
Yeah. Do you think you can help explain that connection between the forest health and our health as
sure.
humans on the planet?
And, you know, that is something I think that in developed countries, we've become very urbanized, which has its merits, of course, but it has drawn us away from understanding our connectivity to ecosystems, and especially when an ecosystem is far away, like the Amazon and other equatorial rainforests. In short, we have these amazing things called ecosystem services, mm-hmm. which are functions that forests are doing while we sleep. You know, those trees keep growing even though we're in bed at night, and those plants keep producing fruits that we might harvest the next day. So these things that we call ecosystem services are really these fantastic opportunities for humans to keep healthy if we allow the forest to thrive. And in the case of tropical rainforests, they are, of course, the lungs of the planet. They produce an extraordinary amount of oxygen. They control a huge amount of gas exchange. They produce foods. They produce building materials. They produce clothing fibers. They store carbon in fantastic ways that nothing else can really imitate or even come close to. They control soil erosion. If you take away the trees, all of that beautiful soil goes into the oceans and silts, coral reefs, and things like that. They control our climate in a big way. They're the biggest magnet for fresh water. That whole cycle of fresh water circulating from a forest down to the ground and back up into the air, of course, is so much altered if you clear all the trees. And there's good data to show that rainfall actually decreases when you remove forests. So we owe all of these incredible services that we take for granted to our tropical areas. But the neat thing is, I think that hopefully people are becoming more aware of these services. If we can produce a dollar value, which is a little tough, then everybody wakes up and they recognize that this is a really important service. And I didn't even mention that most important piece, which is the library of genetics that it houses. And I think the important thing for us in developed countries, though, is that people in the tropics need a livelihood. They need an income. We can't just put a glass dome over the forest and tell them they can't hunt sustainably as they've been doing for generations. We have to figure out really good ways where we, as the the users and the consumers of so much of those materials can actually pay back. And I think that's the big economic challenge right now.
In that vein, a lot of the problems afflicting the world's rainforests are complex, and some of them happen on the level of local indigenous communities, but a lot of them happen on the level of the world trade of the rainforest product. For example, demand for products such as soybeans and coffee have a big impact on the rainforest. How would you describe the interplay between conservation efforts on the local scale versus the global scale?
Obviously, I haven't seen every rainforest, but I have worked in quite a few countries, India and Africa and Peru and Panama, just to give you a sense that I have seen a diversity of habitats, but I'm always learning something new. And in my experience of about 40 years of working in these different forests, I'm always impressed and thrilled by the local conservation ethic, which without Western input is usually very sustainable. There are, of course, the occasional slash and burn, as they call it, cultures, of which the Aboriginals were that way in Australia in those more arid situations. But I think for the most part, the folks that have lived there for generations and generations do hunt the local animals, do use the local materials, but they've really learned to do it in a way that allows their children to have a similar quality of life as they did. So it's unfortunately the consumer who comes into the picture, the well-meaning American and European and now Chinese consumers that are really skewing a lot of those influences on the rainforest in a really big way. You mentioned soybeans, which is huge. I think most well-meaning vegetarians probably don't realize that they need to ask where the soy products came from. And coffee is another amazing example, because if people would pay a little bit more for a cup of coffee and buy shade-grown coffee, as it's called, because the beans are grown in the shade of the existing tree canopy, then we could actually have rainforest and coffee at the same time, which is so fabulous. And then we would have the songbird habitat for all those fantastic migrants, and we'd have the biodiversity. But as it is, when people clear cut because they think they'll produce more coffee beans, they can sell it for a little less, but it really loses the important habitat. So we, as consumers in America, most of all, have huge choices. A lot of our timbers are coming in illegally. They estimate something like 80% of the Amazon timbers are harvested illegally, and half of those end up in the States. So again, people go to Home Depot, they don't think of saying, would you prove to me where this came from? With a little bit more labeling and attention to where our products are made or originate, we could just turn things around in a fabulous way. So there's hope, because I think young people are much more interested and probably will pay attention to things like better history of where products are made and making sure that we don't destroy what we need to live.
What are the biggest threats to the rainforests in the Anthropocene?
In the middle of the night, I don't sleep. I'm going to level with you that I get pretty depressed about what's going on with deforestation. It's huge. Mm-hmm. It's epidemic. We need the forests. We're seeing enormous quality of life disappearing for many cultures because of our greed and our lack of understanding. So I would say the big issues are this kind of deforestation out of sight for the consumer is a huge issue. I think for a lot of people, one case study that I might bring up is Ethiopia, where I'm working really hard right now. They have less than 4% of their forests left. This is not due to anybody's, you know, singular greed or any huge mistakes, but it's because people are hungry and the agricultural practices are very poor. It's getting hotter and drier there, so the forests that remained had a lot tougher time to make a living. And so the last remaining forests tend to be in the churchyards, mm-hmm. which we call church forests. And so now I had to go back over there and work very hard with some locals to educate the people about the ecosystem services. But most important, they said, we need an edge. We need to know where the forest ends, because our cattle come in and eat the seedlings. And then the kids take the dead sticks because their moms need cook stove wood. And so we're building stone walls. It's a very simple solution with the blessing of the church. And we're making these wonderful kind of perimeter delineations, otherwise known as a wall, but you know, just to help everyone appreciate this is a sacred site and they love it. And so, you know, I think out of these negativities can come, again, the positive solution, and the technology drivers for that particular project has been Google Earth images, so we could measure the shrinkage and show the priests how their forest looked from a satellite,
yeah,
which they couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
And then websites. I've been fundraising by putting things out on the web, and I've created a whole community of Ethiopian supporters, including people that have translated my website into Amharic so that I could get donors for the walls that I would never have otherwise met. So just neat ways, again, technology in real world. But, you know, so going back to your original question, we have this dreadful issue, which is deforestation, especially due to lack of education or greed by the consumers in developed countries. And now we have to bring back our technology and our solutions, I think, to make up for what we might have inadvertently caused. And there are some big issues. We can't turn the temperatures around overnight. We're going to have to rely on your generation for these solutions to problems that we might not know about. It could be how to keep libraries of seedlings or seeds, you know, genetic material,
yeah,
because some of them might not do as well in these hotter, drier conditions. It might be that we need to really hurry up and create kind of like computerized maps of the important pollinators so that we can make sure they don't all get destroyed in logging operations. But these are the questions that need to be identified really quickly.
I find the example of the Ethiopian church forest really moving in a way that there's this huge spiritual component to saving the rainforest there. How do you think spirituality fits in with conservation? And have you seen examples of that in other parts of the world?
It's a great point you made, because I think we've probably overlooked the importance of spirituality in a lot of our Western approach to ecology and science in general. But right under our feet, literally, are millions of Americans who love to go to church and who feel that religion is the stewardship of nature as well as of souls. And so in some funny way, science has divorced itself from religion. And this has been really life-changing for me to work with the Coptic priests, especially when we don't even share the same language.
Mm-hmm.
But we both come together with this common goal, which is the stewardship of all of God's creatures, or whatever you would like to call biodiversity. So I think there's a lot of hope in that. And I think if we start to look more carefully at the spiritual side of things in many, many countries, it's the spiritual side that will probably be the conservationist's best friend. I think there's really huge potential, and somewhere we have to break down that wall or the barrier that we've kind of set up, I think, in science to dismiss religion as a stakeholder in the conservation issues. So I hope maybe my small project is one case study that could contribute to that new knowledge, and bringing different people to the table is becoming a really important thing. I think if we can try our best to really get to the table with all of these different people and not just assume that it's only the scientists and the conservationists,
yeah,
that can fix everything, maybe we would have better success. And that, of course, is only if we can communicate.
Right.
We're back to square one.
Well, thank you so much for joining me here today. It was
really
a pleasure.
You're so welcome. I want you to come to the Amazon with me soon.
I hope so. I hope I can.
Goody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?